House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is May 20th. I'm going to open a quick hearing on Senate Bill 40 so that Senator Prozanski can testify, and then close that to Wanda Norman. Senator Prozanski, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Colleagues, I was alerted that when you had Senate Bill 40 before you previously on a public hearing, there was some confusion as to where the bill came from, what the bill was scheduled to do, and how it actually reached its current version. Senate Bill 40 had two components to it when it was coming. Well, actually, had one component basically talking about how the defense bar was working on different stuff, and I'll leave that for Gail Meyer to discuss. I really wanted to talk about the issues regarding the restructuring the violation and penal system for possession of marijuana. Under the current system, we have a two-tier system. If you have less than an ounce of marijuana, it's a violation, non-criminal. If you have anything above an ounce or above, it goes and jumps to a felony B. So that's the second level of B felony. When the proponents for the change came forward, they were looking at a multiple-tier system. But through negotiations and discussions, and myself being part of that, working with the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, also Rob Boivet, who is the current Lincoln County District Attorney, it was agreed upon that there would be a three-tier system, and that's the version that you have before you. You still retain the violation. You would then have a Class B misdemeanor for 1 ounce, but I think up to no more than 4 ounces, and anything over 4 ounces would be a Class C felony. If you note that will that change also does reflect a desire on the part of Rob Boivet, and I agreed that on the since now marijuana is no longer a Scheduled 1 but is a Schedule 2, does have some medicinal purposes and has been rescheduled to the state. He felt that it should be a Class C felony, and I told him I didn't disagree. So when the bill came before us, we did in fact adopt that with the understanding that everyone that was involved in the bill was comfortable with it going to a three-tier system. So basically you have a middle step for those who have an ounce or greater but less than 4 ounces before you'd hit felony level. And I understand there's some desire on the part of the leadership for this to be potentially considered for a broader picture that we have in House Bill 3194, which is the one that we're working through, and 3195 that we're working through in the Public Safety Commission work of the Joint Committee. And I can speak for myself as one of the co-chairs. This was not part of the package. What we're looking at there is dealing with individuals that are more in the distribution as well as manufacturing that are going and doing significant prison time, that would be considered and potentially revised under the bigger plan. And so this is really dealing with whether or not we should have a two-tier system for possession or three-tier for possession.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Senator Prozanski? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, thank you for coming in. It's nice to see you. Speaking only for myself, the questions I had were not so much the merits of the policy, shifting from the current system to a three-tiered system. It was more, there are a couple different vehicles that propose things that are similar but not identical. And for example, I know there was a House bill, I think it's now in Ways and Means, that had a multi-tiered structure, I think based on number of plants, if I'm not mistaken, that mirrored the federal guidelines. There was also, if you're familiar with it, there was also a Len Bias law attached to it, and also increased penalties for, I think, Oxy, if I'm not mistaken, if I recall. Anyway, it wasn't so much, I think, reservations about the underlying policy you're proposing, so much as are what we're doing, is it consistent? We should make sure we're doing this thoughtfully and coherently, if that makes sense.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, I believe maybe some of the stuff that you're speaking of is not actually on the possession of what would be considered recreational or non-medical use. where other stuff that went to Ways and Means, that's in Ways and Means, is dealing with medical marijuana and how it is actually being done. So I know there's a lot of stuff in this session that's going around and has been on the table, but this is the only one that I know of that's dealing with how you might restructure the penalty levels of the possession.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. Actually, with respect, I'm fairly certain that the one we passed out of here to Ways and Means dealt with something very similar, i.e. criminal sanctions, and it created a multi-tier structure. I think it came out of Clackamas County, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, I just want to make sure we get it right.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Hicks.
Oh, thank you, Senator. And indeed, I agree with the good representative. So we didn't have a chance. The bill didn't get vetted in the policy committee in the Senate. It went down to Ways and Means. But what it was I'm not saying this is a bad bill. What happened was it also included such considerations as plant counts in terms of if the police come upon a grow operation, then it gave guidance to what kind of plant counts would be what level of crime or violation. And so, you know, I think what we're thinking is we want to make sure these things are reconciled. And so if we pass this out of the policy committee and off the floor today, then there's another bill pending down Ways and Means. I don't know what's going to happen to it, but it too has a pretty comprehensive outlook on marijuana.
Chair and Representative Hicks, it sounds to me if you're talking plant count, you're talking about manufacturing and potentially distribution. As I mentioned, this here is really focused on just the possession as compared to, because if you're in possession of a plant, then that's above and beyond what has been deemed within our statutes as to possession. Mm. And so, and I would assume that if the bill that's in Ways and Means now that came out of this committee is actually going to move forward, they would do some type of conflict amendments if there were still conflicts once that went. But it sounds like maybe some of the stuff actually may be geared at unlawful manufacturing or distribution.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And Senator Prezanski, you know, brother, I will email you a copy of that bill just so that I would love your... Clearly, you have some expertise in this. I'd love it if you'd take a look at that, and I'd welcome your thoughts about how, if they're different, or if we're doing the same thing, or if we can move forward in both avenues simultaneously. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Appreciate your coming over. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 40 and open an informational meeting from the Multnomah County Reinvestment Work Group. Judge Waller, please, and gang.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. I'm Suzanne Hayden. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Crime Commission, and I'm also a member of Multnomah County's Local Public Safety Coordinating Council. And thank you for inviting us to come speak to you today. And just a little bit about why we're here. We are here to tell you about the conversations that we've been having in Multnomah County as a result of the statewide examination of corrections reform, trends in the corrections division that the governor's examined and the Public Safety Commission's been examining. And we want to just, I'll provide a brief overview of the process that we went through in Multnomah County, and then I'll let the experts from our county speak to you about their perspectives, and then I'll briefly summarize. So you have in front of you an April 2nd report that we submitted as part of a work group to our local public safety coordinating council at our April 2nd meeting, and that's a hard copy in front of you. You can reference that. But I want to first by saying our conversations in Multnomah County started at the end of December and really began in earnest following the Oregon Business Leadership Summit, in which the governor made his proposed budget available to the 1,000 business people that were in the audience. And in that presentation, he stated that in his proposed budget, he wanted to avoid the cost of building a new prison, and he was using $36 million in savings from that avoiding of building a prison to reinvest into communities in order to achieve the best public safety outcomes. It just so happened that our local public safety meeting was the next day, and so it provided us an opportunity to have a local conversation about our system and how it works in Multnomah County and what we would do in the scenario that we had to really manage who we sent to prison and make it much more of a rational discussion. So we formed a work group, which is what everybody does. But our work group was made up of all of our major public safety partners. So the district attorney, the corrections director, the public defenders, the Portland police chief, our local sheriff, our presiding judge, our chief criminal judge, and county and city representatives. We also had staff for the LIPSC and myself. We met a total of 8 times, and we endorsed some fundamental agreements to stay at the table, that we were all working for the best public safety outcomes in our community, that we were working towards continuous improvement, and that we wanted to use data to really guide our discussion. So we focused our discussion on the idea of justice reinvestment and also thinking and acting like a system. We sought to examine the issues locally in order to understand and possibly inform your efforts at the state. So I acted as the neutral convener, and I represent the business community and just the community at large, but I don't represent a specific public safety agency or organization. A lot of our initial conversations following the release of the Public Safety Commission's report, we did not focus on specific policy recommendations out of that report. But what we did focus on was what we could do locally to change the way that we do business in managing offenders in our community, protecting public safety, and optimizing our resource use with the goal to keep our use of prison steady. And it's easier to say than to do, so we really dove into what that means for our community. In order to change the way we do business to impact our use of prison beds, we focused on how we would improve access to information when we resolve a case at the local level. The parties felt that if we were able to use evidence-based tools like risk assessment tools pre-sentence, pre-disposition, that we would have the most effective resolution of a case, of a felony case, and this would improve the decisions about who goes to prison, for how long they go to prison, and whether they could safely remain in the community. So we examined data from our own county's use of prison, and in light of the governor's goal, we arrived at a target of 50 to 80 cases in a year, or 100 to 160 in a biennium, that we'd need to make a different decision on. And instead of sending them to prison, we would manage them locally. And so we needed to examine what impact that would have on judges, jails, DAs, defense attorneys, local police, probation, the offenders, and the victims. So now I'm going to just turn it over to my colleagues to talk about their experience and their perspective, and I'd like to introduce Judge Waller.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Nan Waller. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. And while Suzanne is correct that the governor's recommended balanced budget proposal was an impetus for us getting together, truly what brought us together was the recognition that while we each part of the public safety system has its own mandates that we must protect and follow, we have an innate understanding and recognition in Multnomah County that we are all very interdependent, that what happens in one system is going to have an impact both fiscally and in terms of outcomes on the other parts of the system. And a absolute consensus that we all must share a common vision that we want better outcomes for our community, victims, and defendants. There is nothing more frustrating for a judge than to be doing a sentencing and to ask whether there is additional information, hoping that there's something that will give some light as to whether a sentence will lead to the kinds of outcomes that we want, and to have everyone simply say, just follow the deal. That gives little information to a judge when we are using expensive, resources for this individual, not knowing whether we'll get the outcomes that the community needs versus for a subsequent individual. And we know that it has a cost when we're sending people to treatment. Do we know that they're ready? So this proposal, I think that we will, as a community, embrace whether or not there is ultimately money on the table. The question is what the timing will be in terms of our ability to move forward, because it will give judges, from the judicial perspective, judges far better information at an earlier point in the case. Every day I watch my call docket in terms of how long people have stayed in custody, because that also has a cost to it. From a local perspective, for the sheriff, who in Multnomah County, we've been having emergency population releases for the past year. So if cases aren't getting resolved quickly, then people are being released on an emergency basis. Part of our proposal, I think, will address that, in that we will have earlier assessment, an earlier ability to tell who's going to be really make use of treatment, or who really is more on the road to, you know, we don't really have much locally that we can offer, and we're going to resolve the case as quickly as we can, so that we're not holding people in custody while the defense and the state are getting competing evaluations. Part of our proposal is that we would invest in money to have neutral evaluations done, that both the defense and the state were confident that they could trust, and that we would then have that information available to a judge at the time of sentencing, so that we have some assurance that what we are ordering is really going to benefit both the defendant and the community and the victim. So I think that we've put together a good roadmap for where we want to go in the future, hopefully sooner rather than later if there is the money available to reinvest. But this will lead to better outcomes for our community, and certainly as a judge, I think that judges will be far, far more confident that the sentences that they are imposing are going to do what we hope and what we are obligated to make them do.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Lane Borg. I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders, and I am also a member of our LPSC, our Local Public Safety Coordinating Council, and participated in this. And really, I should, you know, a lot of credit goes to Suzanne, has downplayed her role. She really did help bring the community together, the stakeholders. We have a good system, I think, in terms of cooperation, but the time was right for the right conversation. But my involvement in this, because it was important to me in advocating for my position within the public safety sector, is to make sure that all of the values of strong criminal defense and respect of the right to counsel, as we've all celebrated in this year of the 50th year of Gideon, were there, and they were. I mean, we were able to talk about a system in which everybody was able to keep fidelity to their principles of their organization, yet still try to find common ground. And I came to this from a conference that Scott Taylor, our director of Communities Justice, was able to take several of us down to a conference in Reno about a year ago on smart sentencing. And what occurred to me is that, I mean, you start looking at this, is that not, I know defense attorneys like to harp on a certain ballot measure that has two digits in it, that one digit in two repeated fashions, but one of the effects on our system, post-ballot measure 11 and post-guidelines and then lack of resources, is we have a binary system. We either send people to prison or we do nothing. And we have to change that, and the evidence is there. We now know what is and what we should do. And that is, you know, doing a risk assessment, assessing needs, determining that we have resources to do those, to meet those needs. And as Scott Taylor has kind of beat into our heads and we've all come to adopt, is if we know the risk, if we know the need, and if we have resources to meet that, most offenders, not all, but most offenders can be treated, can be dealt with in the community, and still have public safety. We're not going to, that has to be the standard. We're not increasing crime. If crime increases, that's a failure of the system. But we know that we can do this. And so now the question is going to be, and what really became apparent in the discussions around this in Multnomah County, because this is just our local response, our local this. Other communities may come to different conclusions. But the difference that state money can make is scalability. If we You know, we'll do something. I mean, we're committed to it. This is the right thing to do. But, you know, if we're only affecting five people or six people, it's not going to make the difference that Suzanne was referencing and doing the math that it needs to make. So that's really the assistance that we would need ultimately from the state is to set the standard, incent the standard, pay for results rather than giving details and say, if you do this, then that will be there because that will make the difference. It's clear to us on the number of, you know, navigators, assessors, things that we identified. And to be fair, it was not more money for public defender, more money for the DAs. It was really trying to identify these needs that we could scale up so that we could answer that simple proposition of if we know the risk and we assess the need and we have resources to meet the needs, most offenders can be treated safely in the community. So it was a really powerful process to participate in. Suzanne did a great job in kind of moving that process forward. But I guess it's our real message is that should you get to the point where you can fund justice reinvestment, you know, there really is a there, and we can move forward with that.
Hello, my name is Drew Brosh. I'm the Chief Deputy at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I was part of the discussion regarding justice reinvestment. I want to echo what Judge Waller and Mr. Borg said regarding our ability to meet, organize, and really quickly stand up plans and processes. We spend a lot of time in different sort of regular meetings as a community, a public safety community, in addition to some very specific ones like the conversation we had here. One of the things we discovered as we met and we actually looked at some of the data was that our report showed that already Multnomah County has a lower rate of incarceration overall for average, you know, per case per person going down than many other local systems in the state. And certainly also the case that our Sheriff's Office and Department of Community Justice work together with regard to supervision opportunities, to reentry, to looking at options and incentives where we can safely supervise someone in the community as opposed to taking up those bed days at the Department of Corrections. It's also true, as mentioned, that our jail capacity in Multnomah County, like many in the state, is at capacity. The sheriff is obligated to run a jail constitutionally sound and safe, which puts us at or below capacity. We typically are funded to the current capacity level year to year. That's evaluated as it has been at our local system. Over the last 3 years, we've had an increasing number of what are called forced releases under statute, releases for the sake of managing what we call a jail capacity emergency, which exists in our local area when we have a population of up to 95% of our entire funded beds. It's also true that we have 175 beds in Multnomah County that are currently vacant, unfunded. Some other counties share those numbers, some don't. What is true also is that if this works, if we find ways to defer cases and defer people from state institutions to local community supervision, whether it's 5 cases, 50 cases, or 100 cases, that will affect both the number of people we have on supervision and the number of sanction or sentence days that will be required of our jail system, which is already at capacity. Thank you.
I just want to summarize just briefly that, you know, locally, communities impact the use of state prisons. And the expertise lies in the local communities, and the reform that the state's seeking to hold the prison population steady is a result that the local communities can work toward achieving. The incentive funding proposition just enables communities to do that in this next biennium, and I think that's the important thing behind the incentive funding. So thank you very much for
your
time.
I'd just say the Pew Foundation recognize several evidence-based practices which could go into use without having to dismantle everything else that would probably shut that number down of people coming into the system. But again, we need to send you some money to do the work. So, okay, thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say thank you to all of you for coming. My very first meeting on the LIPSC, Suzanne did a presentation on this report, and I said, you have to come to Salem, and you have to tell us here in the Capitol what our initial conversations about public safety reform ended up trickling down to the county to get together to have their own conversations about how we can be doing things a little bit differently at the county. And because we so often deal with sentencing and risk assessments and things like that in this committee, I thought it would be great to hear how, when a group of people get together and start talking about what systems they're actually using on the ground, that good things can come of it. So I'm really excited about the work that you've done on your own, and hopefully other communities in the state will get together and have the same kinds of conversations, because I think even though we're having statewide conversations, local ones can be equally as effective. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions. This is really an important topic. Do you have a population in mind, a numbers on an annual basis of people that you could put into a program and keep them out of DOC, what that number is, based on level of crimes they're committing and the programs you're working through?
One of the presumptions that we kind of came to was, in order to make this effective for the state, right, it had to be sentences that were really less than 24 months. So we were looking at impacting the prison beds by looking at felony offenders that were presumptive prison, but sort of short-term impact. And that's where we came up with the targeted numbers that I mentioned before.
Maybe just we had a process that was going on in a pilot project, very small level, to look at this similar sort of evidence-based smart sentencing and early assessment. And we were looking under the selection at that point of District Attorney Rod Underhill. We were looking at gang identified offenders that were not the ones in ballot measure, in ballot measure 11, not the robbery ones or assault ones, but the twos, and then some non-ballot measure 11, but still felony, potentially prison-bound offenders that way. It was, we looked at it, and there was a potential, not that every single one of them would get probation rather than prison, but we came up with, I think it was 5 to 10 a month that would fit within that category is what we're seeing coming through. So on an annual basis, you're looking at, 60 to 120. So it fits within that. And that was just, my personal view is we should expand it beyond that. Just look at all the level 2 ballot measure 11s, all the people who are, at risk of having a prison sentence imposed, and then put them through this assessment and figure out whether we can do something different. And I'm sure it would be, it'd probably be double what that is, but we the numbers are there for us to look at.
Follow up with me, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So 60 to 100 potential people, what type of dollars would that require to put together the program that you're talking about here to have those 60 to 100 people?
Well, we
I know this isn't Ways and Means, but I'm curious.
We played with the dollars.
We did play with the dollars. In fact, we played with little green pieces of paper that had dollar signs on them because that was a very sophisticated method. but what we looked at was if you use $36 million as your starting point for the entire state, and we just looked at what our percentage of use of the prison is, and we broke it down that way that we were working with a $6 million figure in the biennium. And that's kind of where we focused. And that's just really rough numbers, but we felt like that was, we could gear up to do this change with that type of investment real time and make an impact in this next biennium.
Chairman Barker and Representative Cameron, if I might further answer, I think if I understand your question, we didn't do that analysis completely, but I think it can be done because one of the things that we came to in our discussion is that even though we weren't sitting there saying, okay, well, Rod Underhill needs more deputies or I need more lawyers at my office to do this, we were getting close to those discussion points because what we also recognized is, and I know this might be, a heresy for a public defender to say, but when we're looking at managing people on the local level, there was a recognition that Drew's office, Sheriff Stanton, needs viable jail beds to do that, not for long stays, but for some of these short sanctions. We know from, say, drug court models that there is it's an integrated process. You need so many jail beds, you need so many probation officers, you need to have DAs and defense attorneys and judges resources available. So I think that information is out there, and that's what I would be interested in seeing, kind of what we do next. If we were to do something like that, what is the per defendant cost of a system like that when you add in those little pieces of what you know you're going to need for a safe local supervision model? And I think that would really be the next step in our process once we came to this conceptual agreement.
Thank you. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And to pick up on that thread, it looks like the number you're working with is about $6.6 million at this point. And it sounds like the group has done a lot of contemplation about the number. And so is 6.6 going to get to your optimal level of achievement here, or is there another number that would be sort of the optimal number where you're able to get? How much do you need to make this work really well?
$1 billion.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't come up, yeah. We didn't get that. What we did recognize was that because we're so interdependent that we needed to look not just at, oh, let's buy more services or assessors, that we needed to look at the district attorney's office, the impact on the courts, the impact on the sheriff, the impact on, and then we need the navigators and the neutral assessors that will get us there. But we really looked at across the board. Everybody's going to have to get a little bit more in order to make this work. And then we have some programmatic pieces that we need to get into place.
Chair Barker and Representative Hicks, this is, I guess, what I was getting at. I think, I mean, yes, we did do that analysis, or we looked at if it was the stated reinvestment dollars and it was broken up in some way that we felt Multnomah County could justify to. That was good to do to understand whether the pie was big enough to matter. Frankly, to come in at 7 o'clock in the morning and meet and go over this and have these discussions. But that isn't the way we should focus. I mean, if we really go forward with that, we should look at what does it cost and build the program that way rather than just sort of what's available to us and we'll find a way to spend it. Because that isn't going to, you know, ultimately give us an answer about whether we're spending the money effectively.
Thanks.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Close the informational meeting. And just to announce, we're going to roll Senate Bill 40A will be rolled over to Thursday. Senate Bill 482 will be rolled over to Thursday. And Senate Bill 82 will be rolled over to the 30th. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 492 and call Bronson James, John Henry Hingson, and Gail Meyer, please.
We're here primarily to respond to some state.
Identify yourself.
Thank you. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We're here primarily to respond to certain discussions and comments made in the hearing on Thursday. To that end, we're wondering if you would permit the balance of the opponents to testify, and then perhaps we could clear up any misunderstandings from their testimony at
go
that
ahead,
point.
Please go ahead and testify, and then we'll go from there.
Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I wanted to just walk through the provisions of the bill because it seemed to me that perhaps there was some misunderstandings as to exactly what it does and what it does not do. The codification of the Brady standard is a two-liner down on lines 25 and 26 of the page one. And then those two lines are the subject of the A8 amendment. The A8 amendment really reads the same. It simply breaks it up with subparagraphs and then expands impeachment of a witness. So the codification of Brady would read, any material information that tends to exculpate the defendant, negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt or punishment, or impeach a witness the state intends to call at trial. That's basically it. Now, this is contained within the existing discovery statute, which is set forth on lines 5 through 7. So, except as otherwise provided in blah, 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 the district attorney shall disclose to a representative defendant the following material and information within the possession or control of the district attorney. The phrase material information is known to parties by way of case law. The phrase within the possession or control of the district attorney is also known by case law. The case law in Oregon is very clear that material or information within the police agency's investigation file is within the district attorney's control. So that has already been clarified. The next part of the bill that's new is on page 2, subsection 2A, and this is relating to timing of disclosure. The disclosure required in subsection 1G shall occur without delay immediately after arraignment and prior to the entry of any guilty plea pursuant to an agreement with the state. If the existence of the material or information is not known at that time, the disclosure shall be made immediately upon discovery without regard to whether the representative defendant has entered or agreed to enter a guilty plea. That's important because very often Brady evidence is not disclosed until way later, and that becomes the subject of a motion for new trial or it becomes a subject of post-conviction relief. So generally, often, sometimes the defendant might enter a plea and or they might have already generated their appellate remedies, and then later the disclosure of the Brady evidence is obtained. And so this provision would say, regardless of guilty plea or when they get it, the state needs to disclose it. Lines 6 through 8 were the subject of what I'm calling the law enforcement fix. It reads, nothing in subsection 1G of this section expands any obligation or right under statutory or constitutional provisions to disclose personnel or internal affairs files of law enforcement officers. There are occasions when material within a law enforcement officer's personnel or IA files does constitute Brady. What this provision says, however, is that the codification of Brady in subsection G does not expand any obligation or right under statutory constitutional provisions to that material. So we're not creating a super duty on behalf of the district attorneys to go find out what is in a law enforcement officer's personnel files. Then the last addition is on page 3, line 19. And this one's important. The district attorney may not condition a plea offer on a requirement that the defendant waive the disclosure obligation in subsection G. That's important because sometime in a very heated case, the district attorney will state, you can have this deal, but you must waive second look. You must waive AIP. You must waive post-conviction relief based on ineffective representation. You must waive appeal. And so what we wanted to make it very clear is they cannot condition a plea offer on a defendant waiving their right to disclosure of Brady material. So that's the bill. There was a lot of testimony on Thursday that, oh my goodness, this is so confusing. What are we doing here? Which is why I created the chart that was passed out to you. And it shows that there are 29 states that do codify Brady in some instance. 15 states use the language that we use, tends to mitigate, tends to negate. And most of these states, I went through it again, use the phrase material or information. So you heard some testimony on Thursday that the phrase material or information is so confusing. It might be an op-ed article in someone's desk. It is not that confusing, because the bulk of the states use just that, material or information. And again, our discovery code itself in the preamble uses the phrase material or information. I've just passed out to you the fact that Texas just passed a bill on Thursday with a substantially similar provision in it. So this is called the Michael Morton Act in honor of exoneree Michael Morton. He did 25 years in prison for a murder that he did not commit. The district attorney did not disclose the finding of a bloody bandana that sure enough had the DNA of the true assailant. But the codification in Brady in that Texan provision reads substantially similar to our subsection G. notwithstanding any other provision of this article, the state shall disclose to the defendant any exculpatory, impeachment, or mitigating document, item, or information in the possession, custody, or control of the state that tends to negate the guilt of the defendant or would tend to reduce the punishment of the offense charged. That reads substantially similar to the bulk of the other states that codify Brady. I will point out to this committee the vote count on the Texas bill in the Senate was 31 yay, 0 nays. In the House, 146 yays, 0 nays. So there was no opposition to this bill in the Texas legislature that they passed on Thursday. I'm done with my part. Happy to answer any question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bronson James. I wanted to speak briefly to a point that was made on Thursday by appellate DOJ. There was a contention made that they estimated an impact of $125,000 per year in litigation that would result from this statute. That number kind of perked up my ears a bit, mostly because there was no testimony as to how they arrived at that number. So I thought it would be perhaps beneficial to go back and review the states that have codified Brady and the subsequent litigation that arose in those states to get a sense of whether, in fact, there is some sort of appellate avalanche that is going to drop when a state codifies Brady. Now, I limited my search to 15 states that use the most similar language to the language that's being proposed in that bill. And I looked through Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, Colorado, Florida, Hawaii, Idaho, Illinois, Maryland, Minnesota, Missouri, Montana, Utah, Vermont, and Washington. I reviewed somewhere over 150, I think, cases over the weekend. I'll start with Maryland. Maryland is the language that is almost verbatim, the language that is proposed here. Since enactment in Maryland, there has been exactly one case that arose through the appellate system. I think most importantly, and I would say that that is actually replete throughout most of them, Alaska codified their Brady standard back in the 70s, and shortly after the statute was passed, there was a case that basically said this statute is equal to Brady, and really the issue hasn't been litigated since then. So then I began looking for what cases might have arisen where just the statute itself was litigated and Brady wasn't, because it seemed relevant to me that if the statute simply codifies Brady and you were going to have a Brady litigation anyway, then that's not really a cost. That's a cost that you would have incurred anyway. So really the operative analysis needs to be looking at where was just the statute litigated and Brady and its progeny never brought into the litigation picture, never mentioned. And of those 15 states, and I will confess, I did not read all of the cases, but I read about 150. I was not able to find a single instance where that occurred. So I'm not sure where $125,000 a year of appellate litigation is generated by this statute. I'll follow up with DOJ because for my own business practice as an appellate lawyer, I clearly need to restructure my pricing models. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is John Henry Hinkson III, and I'm a country lawyer from Oregon City. I've been practicing criminal defense since 1971 in the territorial capital. Last week, I heard the testimony of my friend Joshua Marquis, where he explained to the committee that if the defense intentionally offends and disregards an obligation to disclose under the Oregon discovery statutes, that a court is powerless to suppress the evidence that was improperly not disclosed to the prosecution. Josh misspoke. About 25 to 30 years ago in State versus Mai, M-A-I, the Oregon Supreme Court held that suppression of defense evidence is a remedy that is available to a trial court where the defense intentionally suppresses evidence that it must disclose under the discovery statutes. Now, with respect to remedies, the statute on discovery has a very specific section of it that deals with remedies. And I should tell you that those remedies are as infinite in variety as the charms of Cleopatra herself. There can be exclusion of evidence, which is as rare as hen's teeth. What has happened is that there's been a judicial gloss placed upon these discovery statutes by our appellate courts that says that exclusion of evidence is the most disfavored remedy. Josh got it right when he said the most popular remedy with the courts is to allow a brief continuance so the offended party may attempt to remedy the situation by speaking with a witness, examining the evidence, etc. I would like, if I may please, respond to what was explained about what happened in Texas. I went to the University of Texas Law School, and because I speak so much, you know that I got a full ride scholarship to Southern Methodist University for playing the tuba. And when I was in school, there was a joke that the Miranda decision had been modified in Texas. It reads, you have the right to remain silent so long as you can stand the pain. And Texas should be very proud of what it did in the face of the conviction of Mr. Morton, an innocent yet convicted man. They have remedied that by the passage of that legislation. I pray that this legislation before you will be passed in Oregon so that we don't have a Michael Morton from Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Brandon Lashmit, Doug Harker Road, and Scott Healy.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. I have very limited testimony. Looking at the Dash 7 amendments and the Dash 8 amendments, we were involved on the Senate side on amendments that were placed in the actual bill, and I would point you to page 2, lines 6, 7, and 8. That language was specifically added at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Associations. It's our understanding that the drafters of the bill and the proponents of the bill did not intend to exceed what that language has put in as an exception. It clarifies that exception. It's my understanding the Dash 7s, the second part of the Dash 7s, and I have talked to a representative from the District Attorneys Association. That they're not going to go forward with the Dash 7s, but I wanted to make the point that obviously those lines are very important to the police officers of this state. It was not intended to extend the right disclosure in the area of personnel files and internal investigation records. Let me close by saying that I listened to the testimony on Friday and I hear the discussion, and the major battle obviously is between the District Attorneys Association and criminal defense attorneys, and I'm not going to get in the middle of that discussion. But I did cringe a little bit, and this is kind of a rhetorical question for the three retired police officers that are on the committee. One of the people proponing the bill actually indicated that police officers are ignorant about the Constitution, and that was the reason why this needed to be in statute. I cringed in the back of the room, and I hope as police officers, retired police officers, you cringed as well. Your oath that you took in the state was to uphold the Constitution of the state of Oregon and the United States, and I believe this is more of a training issue than it is any other issue. And with that, I'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I currently represent the Oregon District Attorneys Association as their executive director, and I also represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance as their senior policy advisor. First, to Mr. DeLashman's comment on the A7, amendment, lines 3 and 4. We are abandoning that portion. It should just stay the same. Okay, so that should be clear. I want to tell you a couple of stories, and then I want to talk about this bill. Before I do that, I passed out some written testimony that deals with the issue of whether or not this is a codification of Brady or whether it's broader than that, and I don't intend to talk about that anymore. You've heard enough about that. So, the stories. The first story is I was a young prosecutor some years ago. It's actually before ballot measure 11 and before sentencing guidelines. That was 1989. And I got this robbery in the first degree case on my desk. It was assigned to me. It was a big deal for me. And I read it, and it was a knife point robbery in the first degree. That was a 20-year sentence back then. And I decided to go out to the location in rural Lane County to this little store where this knife point robbery had occurred and met the two witnesses in the store there. And they said, oh, yeah, he had a big knife in a sheath on his belt, but he never threatened us with it. He never did anything except steal from the store. Well, in my mind, that robbery in the first degree was now a second degree shoplift. So we didn't have cell phones back then. And so I went back to the office. I didn't stop at a payphone, and I called the defense attorney and notified the defense attorney that the defense attorney needed to talk to these two witnesses, told them briefly what they had said, and then we needed to talk about a theft in the second degree. Several days later, we settled that case. Okay. That was clearly Brady information back then. It's Brady information today, and I think I did the right thing. Now, I want to tell you another story. Then we'll relate these stories to this bill. One of our senior lawyers, a long time ago, tried jury trial a Mr. Boots and a Mr. Proctor. Mr. Boots and Mr. Proctor were charged with murder for killing a young store clerk at a convenience market, tying him up and shooting him. It was a circumstantial case. The state police lab worked very hard on it. Our lawyer worked real hard on it and went to full jury trial in both cases. Both of those individuals were convicted, beyond a reasonable doubt, of that murder, and they both went to prison. 10 to 11 years later, one of the same officers, Donnie Myers, who worked on that case, walked into my office and says, Doug, we have an informant who tells us that somebody else has admitted to doing that murder. Well, I remembered the old case, of course, and the new one, and I said to Don Myers, you guys work that and you work it hard and you work it fast. And that's what he had intended to do anyway, I think. So the Springfield police went to work. And it took them several days to do the work because we needed a body wire to send the informant back in to get admissions from this guy, and we got some pretty good ones. And as the police officers were going over to interview this guy and arrest him, he committed suicide. We got the gun, tested the gun, matched the bullet from 10 years earlier. Got his fingerprints, matched a fingerprint that was on the inside of the duct tape around this kid's hands that we were never able to identify whose it was. Sounds like a pretty good circumstantial case, maybe a little better that the guy who committed suicide was the killer. So, at that point, I notified the lawyers involved, had him come over to our office. One of them was crying in the office as we explained that their client was not the individual that had committed these murders. Now, so those are two Brady stories, real life true stories, all right? I think I did the right thing on both of those cases. Now I want to move to this bill. On page 2, line 2, says the disclosure required in 1G of this section shall occur without delay immediately after arraignment. Immediately, by definition, means at once, instantaneously, without any intervening time or space. I believe that that word in here obviously doesn't apply after arraignment. These guys, it's well after arraignment, right? 10 or 11 years later, okay? But later on it says, disclosure shall be made immediately upon discovery without regard to whether the represented defendant had entered a plea or, and so forth. That word immediately, I believe, would force me to, when I'm told by Donnie Myers in my office that there is a individual who has made a comment to an informant that they committed this murder, or words to that effect, I would immediately have to pick up the phone and call the defense attorney without running that investigation, and that's a mistake. We should run that investigation. Who knows what that defense attorney is going to do when they get that information? That word is a problem there. Now, let me go back to the other story. The story about the knife point robbery that wasn't, all right? That one, the individual's already been arraigned. We've got an indictment charging a robbery in the first degree, and the police reports have been given out, but that particular case, immediately after arraignment, we didn't know about that. Who's we? Well, I'd suggest to you that it was the police and me that didn't know about that. The interview wasn't thorough enough or whatever it was to figure that out. Somebody missed it in grand jury when it was indicted. And so if the existence of the material or information is not known, which I'd suggest exactly what happened in this case, at that time the disclosure shall be made immediately upon discovery. When I discovered it, I disclosed it. Now, notice the word is not known in this section. What's wrong with the standard that when I know, I'm supposed to disclose? I can't disclose what I don't know. And so the reason for this amendment, the A7 amendment, the first two lines is after information insert known to the district attorney. Now, we've heard about some stories, and we heard another one today about the Texas situation. That's intentional misconduct. You're not going to fix intentional misconduct with a statute. There are rotten apples in all the barrels. There are rotten apples in legislative barrels. There are rotten apples in police barrels, and there are rotten apples in prosecutors and every other profession. Unfortunately, that happens. You will not stop intentional misconduct with this statute. Okay? Now, I believe there will be litigation. The defense bar, they're charged with the responsibility to zealously represent their clients within the bounds of the law. So if this statute passes, you will see a discovery letter, which almost all defense attorneys produce. Thousands came through the DA's office in Lane County when I was there, and it will be modified. It will be modified to include, it's basically the language of the discovery statute, it'll be modified to include this new language. And then we will litigate not so much possession, but certainly control. We will litigate, what does control mean? What is the control of the district attorney on this case? And how wide does it reach? So I have a suggestion. My suggestion is that Kevin Campbell filed written testimony with you folks explaining how the over at DPSST, the chiefs, the sheriffs, the DA's representatives have all gotten together, not because of this bill, but because of a whole variety of Brady issues. And they've set up committees, labor-related issues with Brady, ethics issues with Brady, evidence issues with Brady, DPSST reporting and training, statewide protocol work group, and he asks you to let us work these issues out satisfactorily, and the Oregon District Attorney's Association would ask you to do the same thing. Now, if you are not inclined to do that, although I would strongly urge you to do that, then I would suggest you to make it crystal clear in this bill that it does not do anything other than what the law of Brady requires. And I spent a little time drafting up something last night, and it goes like this. It would be subsection C, and it would be on page 2, and it would come right after line 8. And it says simply, nothing in subsection 1G of this section imposes any obligation on the district attorney beyond the obligations imposed by the United States and Oregon constitutions. Now, that's not my preference. My preference is that you let us work this out over at DPSST. My final point is that what gets lost in all of this is that we don't focus on one case per district attorney's office with unlimited amounts of resources and time. Thanks to Mr. Factor, I now know that in 2011, there were 84,329 felony and misdemeanor cases. I also know that there's currently 322 deputy district attorneys and 36 district attorneys for a total of 358. If you figure that each of them works about 2,000 hours on cases, which is really generous because they have other things to do, you find that there are 676,000 hours available to work on those 84,000 cases. That's about 8 hours per case. Now, we all know that we don't do murder cases, rape cases, robbery cases, or any serious case in 8 hours, which means we're going to do all those misdemeanors in 1 hour, 2 hours maybe, quick dispositions. My point on all of that is that in a vacuum, the district attorney should be out there chasing down every lead, chasing down every piece of exculpatory information. In the real world, that simply does not and cannot happen. When they know, they have a duty to disclose, and they should, just as I did in those two cases I gave you. But in the real world, there's not enough resource to do more than what Brady requires. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Barker, Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee. I've been here, as you know, both last Thursday for all the testimony that you heard on this bill and then also here today. My name's Scott Healy and I'm a senior deputy district attorney in Clackamas County, also representing Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm a little curious to know how all of you feel about all the information that you've heard about this Senate bill. Because you should feel like judges. I mean, as I've watched this whole thing unfold, you are getting a feel for exactly what goes on in courtrooms across the state every single day with regard to arguing these Brady issues. Because, you know, that's the concern that we always have when we start trying to codify a constitutional standard, you know, that is in significant case law, and you've heard some of it. I mean, there's a lot more to it than you've heard even from all the testimony from all the lawyers that you've heard from both sides, basically. And so, I mean, you've heard so much about it. I don't really want to talk about that. I just want to sort of talk about a little bit of the language of the statute. You've heard a lot. And then concerns that I have about, you know, how this might be used. Specifically, and this might go to some of the questions that Representative Hicks had last week, if I recall correctly, and I'm not suggesting that we should change this statute at all, but if in fact you are considering codifying the Brady Bill, then if known to the district attorney is very important to us there in subsection G. If you look at subsection E, just above it, in the already codified statute, It talks about if actually known to the district attorney, any record of prior criminal convictions of persons whom the district attorney intends to call as witnesses at trial. Well, criminal convictions, and also if you were to look at, you know, some other statutes and also some other jury instructions that we have, you know, obviously knowing about any criminal convictions and any witnesses that we might call at trial is very important. That's impeachable information that certainly the defense is going to want to know about. You know, not that you want to necessarily select one thing over the other out of this statute that's more important, but that's very important, and that talks about if known to the district attorney. We, as the law enforcement officers on the committee, know. We have access to lead systems. Defense attorneys don't. We're the ones that get into those lead systems, you know, usually through our staff, and we try to find out whether or not people actually have, you know, criminal convictions. And that talks about if actually known to the district attorney. It's already in the statute. So to place that language, you know, in the statute in subsection G, I would suggest you wouldn't be in violation of Brady. It would also be helpful for all the reasons that have already been discussed. I'm going to talk about subsection G as it's currently written. Make no mistake about it, and don't think for one second that any material or information that tends to exculpate the defendant, negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt or punishment, or impeach a witness is not going to be litigated. And while you heard from some very good defense lawyers on Thursday, and they made well-reasoned arguments, there are going to be members of the defense bar, and as the lawyers, Representative Williamson, Barton, Hicks, Garrett, you know, as a member of the bar, you're supposed to zealously represent your client, and we would expect the defense to do that and take a look at this legislative language, if in fact it's put in there, and they're going to show up and they're going to say, Your Honor, it says, and there was a defense lawyer last week that mentioned the first thing the judge grabs for is the statute book, right? Well, maybe it is. I don't really pay that close of attention, but certainly it's one of the very first things. And they go to those statutes, and they read those statutes, and then we argue those statutes. And we argue, you know, the constitutional provisions. We argue the legislative intent of those statutes. And the judges tend to look at the four corners of that statutory document. And what they almost always say, and Representative Garrett, you're aware of this, they almost always say, well, you know, if the legislature intended this language to be a part of the statute, it would be in there. And since it's not, then, you know, I'm not going to consider that. Certainly we can argue, well, no, but look at this constitutional case or that constitutional case. Well, you know, they did, and I like the term cherry-pick certain language. The legislature cherry-picked certain language that they chose to put in the statute when they codified Brady. And they didn't choose this other language that you're arguing now. And so that must be more important to them. And these are the types of arguments that are going to happen in courtrooms across, you know, the state of Oregon. And because of it, the District Attorney's Association is concerned that our duty is going to go actually beyond what our current constitutional duty is, and that defense attorneys are going to push and they're going to say, well, any information that exculpates my client, Your Honor, and, you know, the state has gone and charged him with some very serious offenses, so it's their job to go run this information down. Well, how far do we go with that? And if you take a look at the letter that Mr. Hawkerow just gave you, I think that talks about our concerns in terms of how far does it go? How far do we have to delve into witnesses' lives, victims' lives, you know, law enforcement's lives? I know they put the law enforcement fix in here, but what about Nike employees? What about Intel employees? Do we need to go look at their personnel files? You know, when does the slippery slope stop? And so those are the concerns that we have. And it doesn't seem to be a significant problem. It's working in Oregon. I heard about how there's not a lot of good training for, you know, young deputy DAs, I guess, across the state of Oregon. That's not my experience. We train deputy DAs very significantly, certainly in my office. My chief deputy just recently gave trainings on the Brady standard and a lot of the case law that you've heard about. And I know that to go on across the state of Oregon. Are there mistakes made? Of course there are. It's not a perfect system. It's run by human beings. And when there are mistakes, you know, there are the appellate cases that address those issues. You know, in all the cases that I heard of on Thursday, and now granted, I guess the one from Texas, that's more significant because it was such a significant period of time. But on all the cases I heard about on Thursday, ultimately the right thing occurred. So I think just in general, you know, that's what we're looking at. So you need to be very careful when we're codifying. We would suggest this statute. And so we would ask that you not do that for those reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Yeah, you mentioned legislative history. Mm-hmm. I think the history on this bill would do nothing but help you, because we've now had two full hearings in which the proponents of the bill and members of this committee have said all we're trying to do is codify a constitutional standard, not expand it. So I think that would, if I were you, that's the first place I would go, is show the court the legislative history on the bill. And to the point about litigating the statute, I'm sure there will be litigation, but I don't see how it increases any prospect of litigation beyond what you face today with the Brady case itself. Can you give me a scenario where you think this bill would open the door to a fight over Brady that wouldn't exist today?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, and Representative Garrett, you make a good point. These hearings that we have had would be something that, you know, obviously would probably be part of that litigation. But I would go to, you know, subsection G and just how broad and general it is without the language that we discuss, if known to the district attorney. Any material or information that tends to exculpate the defendant, negate or mitigate the defendant's guilt or punishment or impeach a witness. And then you go on and look at the information under subsection 2A and B, and it talks about the immediacy of getting that information to the defense. What I see, and I already touched on it a little bit, is that the defense is going to try to push as far as they can in terms of, you know, what is the district attorney's duty, I guess, to go and or law enforcement's, you know, under the guise of the DA, to go in and investigate for exculpatory information. That's the concern. I just want to give you a couple examples.
My question was okay. Going to be, I don't see why that argument wouldn't already be made.
Yeah.
Why couldn't a defense lawyer go in under current case law and say they didn't make the disclosure and didn't make it fast enough? I don't see how this changes the argument.
Well, because the language that's being suggested, I think, as I indicated, pulls some language from the case law and other language from the case law that might be helpful to, say, I guess, the state's argument, which actually Jeff Howes talked about some of that last week, is not put in there. So, I mean, I guess we could argue that, but then the judge is going to say, well, but they didn't choose to put that in here. Well, that's currently the state of the law. Another thing is then what if the appellate courts or the Supreme Courts then start interpreting, you know, the state's duty to be probably would expand of it, maybe something less than is actually required by the statute, because the statute is broad from our perspective. I guess one of the examples I want to give you is that, you know, like, for instance, Representative Garrett, you make some good points. There are arguments made about, you know, well, I think it's the state's duty to go find out if there's any information in the Department of Human Services file. It's the state's duty to go find out if there's further information in the CARES file or whatever it might be. But then we get pushback sometimes, if in fact we're even looking into those things, from lawyers, from the Department of Human Services, from CARES, and then there's even more litigation, you know, trying to quash subpoenas. And we're like, well, it's not really in our possession or control. And certainly defense lawyers have the same ability to go and subpoena those same documents as we do. I mean, there's just a lot going on. But I'm not suggesting that you don't make good arguments, that sometimes those arguments are made and sometimes we fight them, but the law is already clear based on the case law, and judges know about it, and they make these decisions every single day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to Mr. Harkleroad's comment about litigation around control, and actually to a little bit of what Mr. Healy just said about state agencies having documents and having them available to the district attorneys. What's the current case law on control of information, and how is that not something that would be brought up under Brady already? I guess I just go back to Representative Garrett's question. If it's an open question under Brady, it's going to be an open question under the statute. And so if there's litigation over control, there's going to be litigation either way, I think.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, I knew I should have looked up possession and control to be current on that, and I'm not, so I'm going to pass on that. But I am going to offer something. The language, frankly, that really worries me is impeach a witness that the state intends to call on trial. What obligation does the state have to background that witness now? Do we need to check their pharmacy records? Because they looked a little funny when they were in our office and we were doing a pretrial interview or not. It sort of relates to Representative Garrett. I think that we have a bigger obligation under the impeach a witness the state intends to call a trial than Brady requires.
What does Brady require now?
It certainly doesn't require us to do a background on the witnesses that we call. It requires us to run a record check, but that's actually in the statute.
But you think this language would make that a requirement?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. My friends probably don't like me saying that, but yeah, I think so. I think we're going to have to do more on the witnesses that we intend to call under this statute than we do under Brady.
And why is that a bad thing? If what we're looking for is exculpatory evidence and whether or not someone is innocent, why is it a bad thing?
Well, I don't know that it's a bad thing. I think it's an impossible thing under the current state of affairs with prosecutors' offices. They simply don't have the resource to go do those things.
Well, and
it's a big checkbook.
I know. With all due respect on Ways and Means, the defense does not have any more resources, at least the public defense side of the world. And so I guess I struggle with this idea that somehow litigation over constitutional protections is a bad thing. And we've heard a couple of times this session in this very room that we don't have the resources in the budget to do something that's constitutionally required. And I'm concerned about that.
No, Chair Barker, if I may, Representative Williamson, I'm not suggesting that we don't have the resources to do the constitutional requirements of Brady. What I'm suggesting to you is that impeaching a witness that the state intends to call, going out and getting that information and doing that work, there's no, just going and doing that work is not a Brady thing. It's if you find a nugget out there. So there's more work to be done, is what I think, under this. It's broader than Brady.
Thank you, panel. My next call, Lucinda Claybaugh and Daryl Fuller.
My name is Lucinda Heights Claybaugh. I live at 2704 Furwood Lane in Forest Grove, 97116. And I am here by providence. I did not know you were having these hearings. And I was a teacher in public schools for 30 years. I was wrongfully arrested in this state. I was wrongfully imprisoned by this state because of an overzealous DDA. There was prosecutorial misconduct, prosecutorial malfeasance, Brady violations all over the place. And it took me going and winning an appeal. Meanwhile, I was wrongfully imprisoned for 756 days as an innocent person. You want an example? I would be happy to speak at length. I will provide any documentation for anything I say. And I have 150 people who have known me and who had written to the judges involved in this process. It's been 5 years that my life has been turned upside down. As an innocent person who is teaching and doing my job to help students and their families, the life of one person and one innocent person alone and their innocent family not having to go through suffering that I've had to go through because a DA didn't have time is not a good excuse. I would love to be a part of a working group to work with the legislature to help craft a proper law that insists that truth matters. The bottom line is, and this was warned of by Supreme Court Justice, who is now dead, who I greatly admired, but he warned us that there seemed to be a disturbing trend in the aggressive and adversarial nature of DAs and prosecution in the United States and the shadows over the Constitution and Bill of Rights, that an innocent person really didn't seem to have the protections that we are supposed to have. But I am a Quaker, and I do affirm that everything I say is the truth and will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And everything that you need to ask of me at some point at another body instead of this one, if you prefer, I will be happy to cooperate. But it took the ACLU filing an amicus brief and 150 people. It took the United Methodist Church congregation, the Multnomah Monthly Meeting of Friends Quakers. It took the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. It took the Oregon Fellowship of Reconciliation, which I've been a part of for many years. It took a teacher's, substitute teacher's union. It took all the people I'd worked with in my 30 years coming forward saying, something isn't right here. There must be something more to this. And it all started when people didn't follow the law that currently exists. There are statutes that currently exist, and there are state protocols and guidelines for child sexual abuse and what you're supposed to do to be fair and unbiased and to seek the truth in investigation. There was no investigation. If people had investigated, I wouldn't have gone to prison. If the police had done their job, I would not have gone to prison. If DHS had done their job, they're supposed to call CARES Northwest, and a trained, certified, qualified medical mental health specialist who knows how to not lead kids in their questioning goes to that all-important first recorded interview. That never happened. And when you take that away from an innocent person, you've just taken away their chance to prove their innocence. And that is wrong. The truth does matter. And everybody who swears, whether you're a police officer and you swear to the Constitution and you swear that you will abide and seek truth in investigation, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, everybody's got to be held by that. Everybody. And if they're not, then what happened to me can happen to any innocent person. It can happen to you. It could happen to you. It could happen to every single one of you. Out of the blue, your life can be turned upside down, and you keep saying, this is too Kafkaesque. I can't believe this is happening. This is the United States of America. We have a constitution. What's going on? How can they be doing this? But they did, because they didn't investigate. The DA did not investigate. The DDA did not properly investigate. And when she did, and when she did have information, she hid it. That is wrong. That's a Brady violation. What constitutes a Brady violation has to be made very clear. And if we need to have a training, the way they're proposing at the federal level, that everybody needs to have a retraining of what constitutes a Brady violation, then we need to do that. And then they don't have any excuses. Because then criminal intent to destroy innocent people's lives needs to be addressed. It is not okay to have a history of prosecutorial misconduct over and over and over again. I'm not the first person that this particular DDA had dealt with and lied about and was deceitful with and hid evidence on. But I was the first one that had all those friends because I'd lived a good life. Thank goodness I'd led a good life. And everybody knew it couldn't be true. if I had had a chance to present my exculpatory evidence, my exculpatory witnesses, I had a whole classroom of children that were my alibi witnesses who were with me all day and knew I hadn't left them. Right then and there, you cannot be in two places at the same time. But I wasn't allowed to have those witnesses. Through maneuvering, you do need a good lawyer. I learned that if you are poor in America, you don't have justice. Because you have to have the time to investigate, and the excuse that you don't have the time is just not acceptable. You destroy one family's life, that's not acceptable. We have the right to insist the truth matters. The truth is the basis of everything. And if we're so far away from that in law, oh, the truth isn't relevant in this. That's what the DDA had told the regular teacher when she tried to present exculpatory evidence about me and about this accuser who she knew had a habit of lying. She knew that she had a pattern of lying. The counselor at the school knew this kid had a pattern of lying. People knew in the school records there was a pattern. People knew this. None of that got to be heard. In my case, the system failed me. It failed me first through DHS because they didn't call CARES Northwest, which is supposed to be the process. And it, part of the reason maybe they didn't is because it wasn't made clear enough. We can help rewrite that and amend those pieces so that it's very crystal clear that every CARES Northwest or equivalent organization, in this case, they were supposed to take the alleged victim to Liberty House. If a person doesn't go for that first recorded interview, have it properly done so that you have the questions as they're being asked recorded so you can see if somebody led in questioning and didn't do it properly. Then you've got the recording of that. You've got a chance for a person who's innocent to at least have that in their defense. Right now, there is a fear, an atmosphere of fear in the country, that behind every nook and cranny and bush and tree there's a sexual offender. And I understand that people want to protect children because I work to protect kids all my career for 30 years as a teacher. But you also have to balance that out with the understanding that we're not supposed to be on witch hunts here. We're supposed to be doing things based on truth, evidence, and investigation. That means unbiased, complete, thorough, fair investigation. And the processes have to be fair. What you ask yourself is to put yourself in my shoes and say, okay, out of the blue, somebody accuses you of something. What processes would you want given fairly to you? How would you want to be treated? What would you expect due process and fair process to look like? This amendment that you have for G is wonderful. I support it wholeheartedly. If this had existed, then maybe I wouldn't have had to go to jail wrongfully for 756 days in prison as an innocent person and suffer the things I've suffered. That'll have to be another hearing where we talk about what's going on in the Department of Corrections and needs to be changed and reformed. Because I got to be a fly on the wall. You know, that old Robert Redford movie, was it Brubaker, where he goes in and he pretends he's a prisoner because he's the new warden of the prison and he gets to see what's really going on. Well, I had the opportunity, not one of my choosing, but I had the opportunity to see what really happens to people in the criminal justice, injustice system as it currently exists. And I'm an educator. And I'm very interested in helping there to be better training and better improvement to make a system work so that it will be rehabilitative for people that actually have troubles, that there can actually be health care for prisoners and other issues. But that's for another day. Currently, the process is supposed to be that with the state protocols, that DHS people are supposed to call CARES Northwest, or police department is supposed to call CARES Northwest. I had a rookie first-year cop.
We understand. I mean, you, and there's no doubt in anybody's mind that I know of that you didn't get the short end of the stick on this deal. But on the, just on this Brady issue, it, according to everybody, that this is already in effect now, even without the bill, but they want the bill to clarify it.
The problem is that DAs are not following the law. There was even, to the point, I mean, there was a witness who knew that evidence was being hidden. And a quash, a legal quash, a suppression of information was put on that evidence. That person was not allowed to testify because it would have led back to the DA.
Mr. Chair,
an improper action.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt. It's Heitz Klabaugh, right?
No, my name is Heitz Klabaugh. C-L-A.
Mm-hmm. Ma'am, I just wanted to personally, everyone on this committee is familiar with your case. I want to thank you for coming in. Yours is a famous case, and indeed, we actually talked about your case specifically earlier this session when we passed a bill clarifying the ability to. For a judge to issue a stay pending appeal on Measure 11 offenses. That was specifically in response to your case. And I wanted you, again, thank you for coming forward. Hopefully, it's some small consolation that this case has at least prompted us to hopefully make the system a little bit better as we can. And I appreciate your coming forward,
well,
Mr. Chair.
Well, an ombudsperson or a commission that can have the power for oversight of prosecutorial misconduct should be looked into. There need to be some additional, we need to add some other pieces, because if there's no enforcement of what is currently happening.
We're in a little narrower bill today, but I appreciate that, and we can certainly talk about that further.
Well, I was concerned by the comment right before mine from the Clackamas County DDA that, you know, this is not a significant problem, but I would say that only one life and one family's life alone would have certainly been a reason for this to be considered significant. Because every good person whose lives are destroyed and then not able to participate in being a contributing part of the society as I previously was, because of my PTSD at the moment, actually, from my experience, that's reason enough.
Okay, thank you very much for
testimony. I do hope you keep G in there. Section G.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. First, want to acknowledge the gut-wrenching testimony that preceded mine, and just to acknowledge the multiple system failure that she experienced. And as you know, as a retired law enforcement officer, nothing is more heart-wrenching to the public safety community than when something goes wrong, or that when somebody makes a mistake, they try to cover it up by doing something that's wrong, and it just sort of cascades on itself. And even if these circumstances are only one in a thousand, if you're that one, it's statistically significant to you because you're the one that's been run over. And so I certainly don't want to anything that we say to dismiss the importance of the issues that she's faced. And in fact, I would add to what she said, I think most of this is a training issue, not a statutory issue. And one of the things that the sheriffs, and by the way, I invited Sheriff Myers to join me. He's not signed up, but he wasn't here when I signed up. And so with your indulgence, I'll turn this over to him in just a moment. The law enforcement community, including defense lawyers, I think all have the same goal, which is to make sure that the right information is available to people anytime somebody's adjudicated. There's this natural conflict, obviously, between the prosecution and the defense. What we hope to do is to create a system where everybody knows the rules and everybody is well-trained so that we don't have a lot of litigation to try to figure some of this stuff out. There are a lot of states that are passing bills similar to this. Just because they've passed and become law doesn't mean that they've been litigated out and that we actually know where we're going to be 2 or 3 years from now. So the mere fact that everybody else is doing it, not necessarily a good idea to jump on the bandwagon. We might be better off learning from their experiences a little bit before we dip our toes in the water. But Sheriff Meyer is going to describe a process that we're currently currently embarking on that we hope will end in a process of creating a work product that may be substantially similar to what you have today, but will do a better job of protecting people's rights without going too far into the personal lives of law enforcement officers and others in the public safety community. And so with that, I'll let Sheriff Myers discuss what they're working on.
Chair Barker, member of the committee. My name is Jason Myers. I'm Marion County Sheriff, and I'm president of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And it just so happens last week, my association, the Chiefs of Police Association, the District Attorneys Association, and a number of other professionals met at the Police Academy to talk about Brady and the importance of making sure that our system has integrity in it. And one of the things that came out of this conversation was some work to identify how to make the system a little bit better statewide. And so Kevin Campbell's letter really kind of outlines the conversation we had at the Police Academy last week and the direction we're heading as public safety prosecution in Oregon about taking a look at Brady and maybe developing a statewide protocol that would have a kind of an overarching architecture, maybe something similar to Senate Bill 111 that each county could then adopt. And so our suggestion would be is to maybe take this bill and push it into this work group to have the work group report back to the legislature next session with a overarching policy protocol that could be adopted statewide.
Thank you. And whatever else we do, I want to be sure that the police are well trained and DAs as well, but so that, because I know it's different training the way things are done, whether it's Portland or John Day or Curry County or Wallowa County, you want to be sure there's a great structure set up so everybody is trained properly.
Absolutely.
I know we have shortage of training money in DBSST, but this really needs to be done correctly.
Yeah. I agree with the training, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, in my 20 years with the state police, I had some contact with police officers that should not be wearing that uniform. In the state police, not some other agency, and others. So at some point you have to have some accountability and some checks. And those people were not interested in justice. They were interested in getting the prosecution or winning, regardless of whether that person was guilty or not guilty. And we have to understand that that does take place within enforcement. It takes place within district attorney's offices. If you keep that in mind, then you got to say, okay, what can we do to improve the system and bring integrity and belief and support to justice? And that's why I've been listening to this debate here. I think there's some work that needs to be done.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Anyway, thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 492, and we're rolling over it. The next time that'll come up is on the 30th. So it'll be time to open a work session on Senate Bill 697.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 697 comes back from the House floor. This was the prohibits a person from possessing tattoo equipment with the intent to use, if not licensed to do so, and assigns punishments. The discussion on the floor that I'm aware of was revolving around no definition for what equipment used for tattooing means. There, to that end, there's an amendment. It's a Dash 2 amendment. It should be in front of you, which defines what equipment used for tattooing essentially says means a tattoo needle, tattoo gun, tattoo machine, or other piece of equipment manufactured and sold for the purpose of tattooing. So hopefully that lends some clarity so that I think the conversation I heard on the floor was that potentially prisoners use CD players and other jury rig things that may be swept under this bill if it's not made explicitly clear what is intended to be captured. So that is what the Dash 2 amendment is in response to, and there are fiscals that's ready to move if the committee wants to do so.
Are there any questions about this committee? This is a bill that I pulled back off the floor because of the lack of that information. Representative Hicks.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't. I mean, I'm good with it. I voted for it. But
I get it.
No, it's, yeah, thank you, Representative. And So the easiest workaround now is to use like a record needle. So now, yeah. So now the prisoner is doing it legally, but the guy in Eugene was not, or he would have been if he'd used a record needle instead. I don't know. Yeah. So I don't know if the committee wants to move the amendment. I probably won't vote to move the amendment personally, but then I'll vote it out if the amendment gets added to the bill, and we'll send it back to the floor. Because it seems like we're regressing on what the policy this was trying to do is. I mean, if you got somebody running dirty tattoo equipment, giving everybody hepatitis, that's the underlying motive here for passing a bill. And so if they're doing it using something other than a piece of equipment manufactured and sold for purpose of tattooing, that's perfectly legal. It continues to be perfectly legal under the amendment. And
he's got a point. So,
at least it's clear.
I guess it's clear. Anyway, there I am.
Anybody want to move the amendment?
I don't.
Okay. I don't.
I won't take a stand.
No, that's okay.
You know, Mr. Chair, you got to remember what the testimony was all about. Yeah. It was the officer from Springfield Police Department talking about what was going on with Thurston High School. And we didn't really hear much more, supportive evidence. I mean, with that, I don't know if right now is the time to be moving forward with this bill.
Maybe not.
No further discussion.
I'll take the other issue here.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
We'll close the public hearing. We'll set that also.
That was the big deal. Yeah. It was the minors.
Thank you.
I think 30th. I think I'll make it. Yeah, it was